Thank you. So I've already warned the locals that this is the same talk pretty much that I gave to a different program 2 months ago. Progress has been incremental. I think the main change from now to then is that Dave has gotten older. Today is his birthday. Happy birthday, Dave.
Thank you. Okay, so now I'm sorry I ever signed up for Facebook. That's the only reason Joe knows.
That's the only reason Joe knows. That's right. That's right.
No, I'm leaving town.
You know, I would have liked to say I put more math into the talk in honor of this program, but that's not true. So, you know, these days when one thinks of ADS-CFT, one usually thinks of it as a way to solve strongly coupled gauge theories or to model the physics of heavy ions or even condensed matter systems. But it's important to remember that all of these activities are just ADS-CFT's hobbies, and its real job is to construct quantum gravity. And it provides what is, so far, our most precise theory of quantum gravity, at least in a space-time with anti-de-Sitter boundary conditions. So that's a cartoon of anti-de-Sitter space, a box that holds gravity. And at the very least, what the dictionary, the dictionary tells you is the measurements that we made by an observer who sort of lives outside the box and perturbs the boundary, throwing things in, something happens, and then seeing what comes out. And maybe it's more than that, but even at that level, one learns a lot. I mean, the most immediate thing one learns is that black hole evolution is described by ordinary quantum mechanics. Most important thing, pointing the answer to this old paradox, and lesser sort of paradoxes and claims about quantum gravity. For instance, these are more abstract, but you know, claims that quantum gravity can't be Lorentz invariant. This provides a construction in which at least some of the Lorentz generators are obviously exact, some of them are manifest. Another more sort of exotic thing, Euclidean wormholes. So space-time fluctuations where a hole opens somewhere and closes in space, and the other end is somewhere distant in space and time, which have been discussed at various times in the past in the context of the path integral over metrics, they can't be in here. They just would satisfy, the theory would not, it's too local to allow that. So there are no Euclidean wormholes. Again, these are kind of more abstract and less direct arguments. This is the real payoff so far. And these are all things that one learns. Of course,
you can't have, of course, a trivial topology inside when you continue inward.
You certainly can have, yes, I should say yes. You certainly have states states in the gauge theory that correspond to different topologies in the book. So you can see of course, we already knew this in various other ways, conifolds and so on, but you can see topological transitions, right?
Yeah, but I was raising
the Euclidean wormholes. Well, Euclidean wormholes have the property that they sort of are non-local in time in an extreme way, because one end could be here, and one end could be way up there. There's no way the gate. The old story was that this would give you a bulk theory, which had not a definite action, but some random action, and so everything you calculated would be some probabilistic sum over field theories, and that would not satisfy, from the point of view of the CFT, that would not satisfy cluster decomposition, right? And it's So this is a paper a few years ago with Nima and Jacobo Ruggiero, finding an example of ADS-C where there were wormhole data points and then arguing that they weren't part of the path integral. So the regime where you have classical gravity in the bulk is a strongly coupled limit of the gauge theory, where you can't calculate. These are all things that you can say just conceptually without calculating. If you could calculate, then, you know, so assuming that you were smart enough to solve the gauge theory or had a big enough computer, you know, then you could learn a lot more. You could direct these things at each other at high energy and determine the result of trans-Planck, for example, the S matrix at trans-Planckian energies, and so on. But this just requires you to solve the gauge theory, but it's something that that this describes in principle. So this is pretty good, but this is much, much less than one wants. Again, it's all the observations of someone who lives on the outside. How does one think about observers like us who live in the middle of the gravitating space? And ultimately, of course, we don't live in a box like this. We live in a space-time which looks something like this. So there's some kind of singularity-ish thing in the past, maybe. And then there's maybe the De Sitter region that decays into a later De Sitter region, and maybe it decays into a negative cosmological constant region that crunches, and another one over here. And every once in a while, you decay into a supersymmetric vacuum, and so you get something like that. So we live in a space-time like this that has no walls in a spatial direction. The closest thing it has to a boundary is this initial singularity or this final, very chaotic, future infinity. And so the real question is how does one take this, you know, very well, this tremendous construction of quantum gravity, is this very complete construction in this special set of geometries which are asymptotically ADS, and again can have more complicated topologies in the center. How does one take the lessons of this and extend it to space-times like the one on the left? And so, I don't know. But what I want to talk about is various ways of, ultimately one has to think about what's happening in the bulk without the boundary there. The boundary is in here. One has to understand holography or whatever, you know, more quasi-locally in the bulk. And so the things I want to talk about have to do with how you see local bulk physics coming out of the field theory. And so my outline, to the extent that I can get through it, this is a number, so this is not sort of one coherent story, but a number of different attempts to understand this, which I'll just kind of describe briefly. And this is various, some of this work is old, some of it's in progress. And it's with Jamie Sully and Itza Heemskerk and some of it Joao Pinedones, who's now at Perimeter. Okay, so first. If we look at sort of ADS, a region kind of near the boundary, and we look at a couple of excitations, you can have excitations that are far apart in the bulk, but are on top of each other from the point of view of the CFT, and we know that they from the bulk picture that they're separate, they don't interact strongly with each other. How can we understand that from the point of view of the CFT? It seems like a miracle. Now, part of the answer has to do with the idea that this emergent direction is energy scale in the CFT or length scale, inverse length scale. So if you take each of these excitations and kind of project it on the boundary, they really are different sizes. And so part of the answer as to why these things don't interact strongly is that things tend not to interact effectively with things much larger or smaller with themselves. The interactions are strongest with things of the same size. But this can't be the whole story. This is not enough. Because the locality of the bulk is much sharper than this. So let's call this coordinate here Z. and it has units of length, so Z is also kind of the size of these shadows. And this gives you locality with kind of an accuracy delta Z over Z of order 1. So if these two things were, if these two shadows were almost the same size, you would expect it to interact strongly. There'd be no reason they couldn't. It's basically light, sorry, I should run it at 45 degrees, but I didn't really have room. It's basically light. That's one way to think about it is the following. If a particle starts on the boundary, I'm trying to draw it. The problem is you're right, I should draw it more like this. Because if a particle starts on the boundary and propagates into the interior, what's happening in the CFT is it's starting as a local excitation and expanding outward at the speed of light. So that's a better way to draw the picture. Thanks. Yeah. But this notion of locality with respect to energy is, again, at best an order one thing. And if you think about what this means in terms of distance in the bulk, this gives, so delta Z over Z of order 1, this explains sort of locality in a very coarse way, where the distance between things is of order the ADS radius or larger. But of course, that's a scale that can be arbitrarily large relative to the physical scales like the Planck length and the string length. And certainly we expect local physics down to these much smaller scales, and just saying that you have locality and energy isn't enough. Just this dictionary between radius and energy isn't enough to explain locality so sharply. So, question.
So this, in my mind, has been one of the things that should be a little vexing about this. That mm-hmm. On the one hand, we have a mechanism for locality on some scales.
Right. Yes. Why do we?
We're supposed to have a different mechanism on other scales, and how are those supposed to?
That's a good question. That's a good question. Right. Why? Very good. Why is the why is with energy? Why are you seeing with energy part of the story and not the whole story? Why do you need two mechanisms? Why is one not enough? Presumably there's only one mechanism, but somehow, it's a good question. I don't have an answer for that. Yeah. And in fact, there's more to the story than that, because there's also locality in the phi sphere. There's also locality in the phi sphere direction. Somehow the energy that we focus on is right. I can use this picture again. So the first thing is to characterize this sharper locality. And so you can take the four-point function and fold these sources into some kind of wave packet in such a way that as they propagate into the bulk, they're fairly focused. And now if you change one of the wave packets by a little bit, then they'll miss each other. And so the four-point function folded into these wave packets is very sensitive to the precise form of the wave packets, and it's not obvious why that should be in the CFT. Why should the four-point function have this property that a small change in the type that I described makes a big change in the answer? So this is one way to characterize the sharper locality that one is looking for. And if you think about it, it's not really something that is well tested. The tests tend to focus on BPS things like two-point functions and three-point functions, where they're highly constrained by symmetry. And this is something which is you know, not by, the reason it's interesting is precisely because it's not highly constrained by symmetry. And I should mention, okay, so it's nice to say in terms of packets, but Gary Giddings and Penadones nicely refined this criterion into the statement that the four-point function has a certain singularity. So they got you can state it in a more intrinsic way without sort of referring to the packets, a certain singularity. So the four-point function is a function of two cross ratios, and that's in any number of dimensions, which you can assemble into a single complex thing z, which looks like the coordinate. So if you think about the 1+1 dimensional case, you know, the four-point function is reduced to a single complex number, and really you can do that in any number of dimensions, where with the usual convention, there are OPE singularities as z goes to 0, 1, and infinity for the four-point function. But this Lorentzian process, that's Euclidean, this Lorentzian process corresponds to a singularity where you continue independently in z and z bar, go around to the second sheet, and it's this. It's at z equals z bar on the second sheet. And so this sharper locality is the statement that the four-point function has not just the obvious singularities in the obvious places, but a singularity over here.
The conformal blocks, which were written by Dolan and Osborne.
Right.
And so should we not see the singularity?
Good, very good. So the individual conformal blocks have a singularity there which is weaker than the one that you need. And the
constraining how you're putting together the conformal blocks.
The stronger singularity has to emerge, again, in this limit from a sum over conformal blocks. Yeah. Did that in rational conformal field theory, you guys were continuing all over the place. I mean, did this play any special role? No. But the fact that the conformal blocks have singularities in places besides the obvious ones doesn't directly enter?
They don't.
No, they do have singularities besides the ones that, in two dimensions they don't, right? In four it starts, right. But this, let's see.
So did anyone notice those?
I don't know. I don't know if they've been commented on. So, okay. So, just briefly, this property hasn't been tested, but so in order to even have this discussion, in order for there to be an issue, one needs these large ratios. The fact that the ABS scale is much larger than the Planck scale says that you have many fields. The fact that the ADS scale is much stronger than the string scale says that the TUF coupling is large. And actually, it says really more than that, because it says that there's a large gap in the spectrum of dimensions. So for stringy states, the dimension is of order this ratio, LADS over L string. So these are necessary conditions for there to be some sharper notion of locality. And these are such special conditions, especially this gap in dimensions, that it's plausible that they're also sufficient. And in fact, one can show that, at least one can show that let me be precise about what one can show. So suppose you're given a conformal field theory, and this is all you know about it. So there's the usual large n factorization for the amplitudes. And because of this gap, what this gap means is that in practice, in the operator product expansion, there's only a finite number. Well, the basic way to implement this assumption is that there's only a finite number of single trace operators appearing in the OPE, the only levers you have are the OPE, conformal invariance, and crossing. In more than 1 plus 1 dimensions, I don't think anybody knows of a useful analog of modular invariance. But in fact, these are enough. With this assumption of a large gap, these conditions are enough to allow you to actually solve for the theory. You can solve these solutions, and the solutions are in one-to-one correspondence with local bulk interactions. You can solve for the four-point function. Yeah. Solve for the, actually good. So let me solve for the four-point function of four scalar operators to the leading non-connected order, to leading connected order in 1 over n. And the solutions, again, are in one-to-one correspondence with the local bulk actions. That is, they are all given by, every solution can be obtained from ADS-CFT with a local interaction in the bulk, which is a much more practical way of what it means by local physics. Now, you might worry that if you have, there's an infinite number of such local bulk interactions, you might worry that if you have a number of local interactions, what does it mean, because you can sum them up. But in fact, if you have a sum of these, the sum has to converge sufficiently rapidly that it has effectively zero range. So there's a real sense in which you can conclude that that the physics is local. Again, I like this. It's one of the few cases. It's like rational Knoll field theory. Again, it's one of the few cases where you have enough leverage from the abstract principles to actually construct the theory, at least in this approximation. Now, it leaves. I mean, there's a lot more.
This question. What about n, and what about coupling constant?
So the coupling constant enters only through the assumption. It's the asymptotic large lambda theory. So it's only the lambda has effectively disappeared because the.
The dimensions depend on lambda also, right?
Some go to constants and some blow up. The ones that blow up are gone. The ones that go to constants are at the value, have reached their asymptotic values. Right. Right. So, there's lots more one could say about this. I should say that a number of people, and I think I should especially mention Joao again and his many collaborators, have extended this and refined it. In particular, what Joao has shown is that if you deal not with the four-point functions, but with the Mellin transform, then the thing that we did worked very hard to do becomes much more transparent, and you can go much further. He's actually made progress very recently with our collaborators on the conformal blocks for tensors, higher spin fields, for the first time. And he's also made progress using the Mellin transform with various collaborators to calculate Witten diagram, to systematize the calculation of Witten diagrams to where it may become possible, practical, to calculate, you know, much higher orders in the bulk. Okay. Now, coming back in some sense to Steve's question about, you know, where is locality really coming from, there's an intuition which many people have stated in different ways, which seems like it must be right, that it has to do with the fact that you're dealing with a conformal field theory, which is a theory of matrix fields. In particular, from one point of view, what the transverse space is just the moduli space of the scalars. You have, in the n equals 4 theory, you have a six-dimensional, six scalars, which give a moduli space. And a completely different perspective on where the bulk spacetime comes from is just the eigenvalues of those matrices. And one can understand to some extent, you know, why those eigenvalues get replaced by energy, how local they are depends on the time scale over which you look at them. But The matrix structure, it hasn't appeared here explicitly, but it's sort of here implicitly, because in every case I know of where there's this large gap, the field theory is essentially a matrix theory. And an interesting non-counter example to think about maybe is the n equals 2 theory with nf equals 2nc, which has, again, a marginal coupling that can run between 0 and infinity. And one might have thought that as that coupling goes to infinity, you would again get a large gap and a large hierarchy, and you don't. Actually, it's complicated. I don't think it's fully understood. The most detailed work is by Rastelli and Gatta. But here's a case where you might have thought you would generate a large gap of dimensions, and you don't. And it's not a matrix theory. It's not completely a matrix theory because you have the flavors, and essentially you have as many flavor degrees of freedom as color degrees of freedom. So in some sense, the world sheets have lots of holes in them. So there's an indirect connection between maybe this gap and the fact that you have a matrix theory.
The n equals 2 star would be a matrix theory.
N equals 2 star. That's the n equals 4 that you've perturbed. Yes, this is not that. This is not that. Right. So you say there's a case. Okay. So there's a case where, again, there's no gap. You said.
I don't know.
Yes,
this is saying that Rastelli's method is applied equally
well,
and it was
2 star.
He doesn't want to
put masses. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, this is one which is interesting because you can take the coupling to infinity, and yet you still can't. Okay. Anyway, as I said, Joao has pushed this a lot further using the Millen transform, but I would see, I would like a more physical way to think about it. Solving the crossing is very technical, and it's not obvious why it works. It's just counting of solutions. And if this is a principle, there should be a more physical way to derive it. In particular, there's lots of instances of gauge gravity duality, like non-conformal D-brains and matrix theory, where you don't have nearly as much symmetry, you don't have conformal invariance. And so it would be nice, to have a way to think about this that doesn't rely so strongly on the symmetries of the problem. And I'll say a little bit about an attempt at that direction in part 3. So let me jump to a different subject.
What about all the matrix models being available
for the old matrix models?
Right.
See, the old matrix models never had any hierarchy. But the strings, they didn't have any physics below. The curvature scale and the string scale are the same. The gradient of the dilaton is of order 1 in string units. So they're like this theory without this hierarchy. It would be great if one could use the old matrix models to ask this kind of question. But they're sitting where the curvature scale and the string scale are comparable. Yeah.
So one comment, I don't know if you're going to get on to this, but this problem of decoding the hologram, I think, involves various things. And one is having a description of the Hilbert space, good approximate scattering states that look like scattering states, in a large radius bulk. Another is getting amplitudes between them to be correct, which is roughly this story. So I don't know if you'll say more about the question of scattering states, but there are.
No, I'm going to move on to a different sort of way to ask about the bulk. Which is the following. So as I said, the ADCFT duality reports about the observations of someone who sits at the boundary, throws things in, and catches them. And suppose now you have a black hole, and you have some quantum event that occurs behind the horizon. And this is, a number of people have talked about this kind of thought experiment, and I think this version I'm talking about really goes back to Sacchino and Susskind. But you throw a couple things in, And then they get to the interior, and behind the horizon, there's some quantum amplitude where they either don't scatter or they do scatter. And now, of course, this is something that you can't see out there. But the question is, can you make a measure? If you are, you have this gauge theory, you have its wave function, can you sort of make a measurement and determine what the outcome of that quantum event was? And if you think about it, the answer has to be yes, because you can take the two possible final states, this one and this one, evolve them back to before they black hole form. This is, I like to think about black holes that form and then evaporate rather than those that are there forever. Evolve them back to before the black hole form, evolve them back basically to where everything comes back to the boundary. And you can then identify what state in the CFT is this state, what state in the CFT is this state, and then you can take your state here and you can project it on those two states. And so yes, you can make that measurement. So ADS CFT duality really has more than the observations of an observer in infinity. It has everything. It's dual to the gauge theory is dual to the entire bulk theory, even parts that the observer in infinity can't see. But there's a nice elaboration of this thought experiment with Veronica Hubney, which you might say, well, if you can't see, how do you know you got the right answer? But in fact, you can. Well, it's going to clutter the drawing. But you can consider a situation where you actually can decide after you make the measurement whether or not it's behind a black hole horizon, because you can throw the initial particles in, you can make the measurement here, and then you can throw in a shell of matter, which will retroactively, because that's the way these things work, put the scattering event behind a horizon. And so you have two choices. You can make the measurement and then wait and see what comes out and verify that you got it right, or you can make the measurement and then throw in a later shell of matter such that the entire thing is invisible to you. So the lesson is that this ADS-CFT implements black hole holography in its strong form, where the Hilbert space of things behind the horizon is contained in the Hilbert space of the field theory, and in particular, if you wait for the black hole to evaporate, where this is the entire Hilbert space, then this Hilbert space is contained in this Hilbert space in some highly encoded, thermalized way.
CFTC is basically unitary scattering?
Well, the fact that the CFTC is unitary scattering is a given because it's a CFT. But this is a further, this is if you think about what that means, one reason for asking this question is because over here in this picture, you have observers which are behind each other's horizons. You have observers all over the, well, actually you don't, but you could have had observers all over the place. And the question is, which what is even the framework for describing all of those observers? Is it one big Hilbert space that contains all of these? Is it one big Hilbert space that contains all of these other Hilbert spaces within it? And it's not even clear where to start. And I don't know where to start. But here's one thing to think about that there may be one big Hilbert space that contains in it the different, into which are mapped the different Hilbert spaces of observers who see smaller parts of the whole space-time.
It was also Beck reaction, basically.
Pardon?
It sees everything. You said it sees everything, including Beck reaction.
Sure. Yeah.
So what right do we have to build a Hilbert space that contains observers not in causal contact with each other?
Well,
completely different sectors, maybe.
So there's sort of a weak form of holography, which says that you never try to ask about the relation between this observer and that observer. But that, I think, but that's a weak form. There's a stronger form of complementarity, which says there's one Hilbert space and everything is in there, is encoded in that Hilbert. This what this is saying is that there's a stronger thing which is true.
On the left picture, of course, one can look at observations small as compared to the big horizon scale.
Uh-huh.
And there, like in the right picture, you might ask the question of the flat space limit of the S matrix. And there, if you want to start unitarity, you know what the correct way of doing that is. It's S dagger S equals
mm-hmm.
1.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to have some set of amplitudes in the bulk that obey that condition.
Yeah. So another way to say this, and actually, let me. There's something missing. So this is. It's nice to sort of do this thought experiment and think of what it means. But right. So I just want to mention there's an old something that goes back to the early days of ADS-CFT, which is this idea of constructing field operators in the bulk. So one thing that you would like to do, is to, so Z is this direction. One thing that you would like to have in some form, if you want to talk about, you know, bulk physics, the bulk of bulk physics is described by some low energy effective field theory. You would like some way to identify those fields in the conformal field theory. And actually, there was an exercise done in the early days of ADS-CFT. You basically take the field and propagate it back to the boundary. Now, propagating it back to the boundary is kind of an odd thing because the boundary is not a Cauchy surface for the bulk. Nevertheless, it's actually more than a Cauchy surface. You can write the bulk fields in terms of fields near the boundary, and then use the ADS-CFT dictionary to express them in terms of fields in the CFT.
Possibly by classical equations of motion, nuclear reconstructed from the boundary value.
Good. So it does by construction in this case. By construction. So there's various ways to think about this. One of them is just what I said. You assume the bulk dynamic. You assume the bulk equation of motion. You do this kind of non-Cauchy evolution, and then you.
This is just at the free level.
So good. So it's interesting because in the year after Maldacena, several groups. Yeah, this is a good question. Yeah, this is in the year after Maldacena, several groups did this at the free level, and actually they got very confused going to the next order. So at next order 1/n, there's something bilinear and so on. And in fact, in retrospect, they shouldn't have gotten confused, because this has recently, over the last several years, been revisited by Cobbett, Lowe, and Lifshitz, who have shown that you can extend this construction order by order in 1/n. There's no obstruction. And it's actually I won't go through the details here, but actually it's so simple that those of us who didn't do it 10 years ago should be embarrassed, because it just involves identifying a Green's function in the bulk and then using Green's theorem in a not very subtle way to express the field here in terms of the field. All you need is any Green's function whose source is at any Green's function with any boundary or initial conditions whose source is at the desired point. And of course, there are many, many solutions to that. There's an enormous number of Green's functions because you're free to take different boundary conditions. And so there's an enormous ambiguity in this construction, but there is at least one solution. So order by order 1/n, and another thing, the original papers, not Josef Banja's, but the other ones, use very heavily the symmetries of ADS space. But the Cobbett et al. Construction is sufficiently flexible that it doesn't require any symmetry. It would even work for a black hole space-time. It would allow you to construct the fields in here. Again, order of magnitude 1 over n in terms of the fields at the boundary. I should mention, if you look at these papers, that they do a lot of stuff, but the Green's function argument is buried in one appendix of one paper, and I just think it's very nice because it's so simple, and again, a lot of people, including me, just overlooked it. Okay. This is again good. It's really just kind of using the ADS-DFT dictionary and expressing it in different ways. But it's got limitations. One obvious limitation is in the way that I've described it, it depends on knowing the bulk dynamics. It's not smart to find these fields. It's not just that you have to be smart enough to solve the gauge theory. You have to be smart enough to solve the gauge theory, and then on top of that, smart enough to solve for the bulk evolution. You would think that the gauge theory is supposed to do everything for you, so that somehow if you have, you know, infinite power in solving the gauge theory, you can look in it and identify, you know, the local physics and the bulk of these fields in some intrinsic way. And there's obvious criteria that you can impose. One of them is, of course, that these things should more or less commute, as much as one can in the theory of gravity, more or less commute at space-like separation. That's not enough to determine them. But if they commit a space-like separation and they have the right boundary limit, and I think it's also necessary that the construction kind of commute with time evolution, then probably the fields are unique. Although it still depends on the fact, it still very much depends on the fact that we know what the dictionary is here on the boundary. If you're given some abstract theory with no obvious boundary and no place to even start your dictionary, it's not clear it's not even clear what you would do, what you're looking for that you would identify as a local operator, because just the statement that they commute at space-like separation is much too weak. You can make unitary transformations and things. You need the boundary in some sense to pin down the construction. Okay, so I'm going to move on to part three here. So one way to say what you'd like to do is you would like to start with the CFT. Some path integral over gauge fields, and by a clever change of variables, turn it into a path integral over metrics and everything else. So here's your CFT, and here's your bulk. And if you could do that, that sort of subsumes the things that I've been talking about here.
What's left in here in the classical everything?
Very good. Even to talk about these local operators, you have to assume that you're in a part of the Hilbert space that has a classical geometry. That's right.
That's a different statement.
That's a different statement. Although, again, this change of variables might only be good in regions where there's an approximate local geometry too. But, you know, this is what you'd like to do. Of course, this is what we tried to do with dualities for 30 years and usually don't know how to do it. But it's interesting because you have a lot more fields here. You have an extra dimension, and you got to figure out where it comes from in the CFT. And I'd like to, you know, make a suggestion, which is based on looking at the renormalization group. And so, by the way, Douglas, Mazzucato, and Razamat have done something very similar to this for free CFTs in 2+1 dimensions, turning them into higher spin theories in the bulk. And I don't understand the details of their work, and it's not clear that they've fully succeeded in what they set out to do. But for them, the normalization group was the right tool, seemingly, to turn the one into the other. And again, the real question is, where do you find the extra dimension and these fields? And this is going to use the energy scale again, which I told you wasn't enough, but then we'll talk about why it's not enough. So if you have the CFT, you can separate the path integral into high energy. So A is all the fields of the CFT. Low is low energy. H is high energy. And then the Wilsonian action, you integrate out this, and you're left with S. So there's some cutoff scale, lambda, S e to the minus S lambda.
Is this a good procedure if the
Sori's came in
invariant?
It's sure. Well, I thought you were going to ask. You can always do it. In fact,
there is no clear cut separation.
Well, no, the whole point is the separation scale is arbitrary, and there's information in that statement. Right. But you're always talking about observables that have some scale, so it's always relative to something. Right. Now, the analogous thing in the bulk theory is, again, seemingly, if we're going to pursue this idea that energy is scale, to separate it into the fields close to the boundary, the high energy scales, fields, the fields far from the boundary, low energy fields, and in this case, we also have the fields on the interface. And so the analogous thing in the bulk would be the path integral over the low energy fields. In this case, the action is kind of additive. The path integral over the high energy fields. And the path integral tilde is the interface fields. And somehow there's supposed to be a correspondence between these two procedures. So if you think about, let's think about what this part is. So this is the low energy fields with the fields on the interface fixed. Roughly speaking, this is like the CFT with an action, the CFT cutoff. So I used lambda for the CFT and Z, which is a length for the bulk. So this is the CFT cutoff at some scale 1 over z. With an action, what's the action? So the data that goes into the action is the boundary values of the bulk fields. And those are in one-to-one correspondence with the single trace operators. So roughly speaking, this part of the bulk path integral, one doesn't know what the cutoff is. Single trace, just because that's all the data that one has here. What's fixed on the interface is the bulk fields, and the bulk fields are in one-to-one correspondence with the single trace.
Basically, you're using this statement here that you can actually reconstruct from the.
I'm not using this. It's probably isomorphic, but I'm not using it. I'm sort of coming at it from a different way of thinking about it. Right. Right. Yeah.
Can I do this for arbitrary gauge coupling?
Yeah, the gauge coupling is one of these. That it's, you know, it goes with the operator F mu squared. Good. Let's suppose that we're working in the 1 over n expansion because I'm about to make this distinction between single trace and double trace that Greg just raised, and that distinction becomes sharp only in the 1 over n limit. Okay.
Jumping the gun, but this is where you might come back to the earlier question about how do you take this inside the ADS radius?
So, good. Good. Actually, there's. That will come back. We'll come back. Yeah, that will, I promise you that we will come back to that because it's sort of what this leads. This does one thing and doesn't do another thing. Good, good. Okay, but what about the rest of this? So. Again, there's the path integral over the fields near the boundary, but also the fields on the interface. Let me call this thing here the result of integrating at the high energy fields. Because I want to focus on the integral of the fields on the interface. So if we take, let me rewrite that second line there. It's CFT with action integral d phi tilde. And so, in fact, if you think of, so the integral of the fields near the boundary looks like Wilsonian action, but the integral over the fields on the interface does something here, and it does exactly what Greg was worried about, because if you think about it, suppose that this thing was Gaussian, then when you do this Gaussian integral, you're going to generate double trace interactions. More generally, this is just some functional of the boundary field, and so the actual running action for the gauge theory is not this thing, but it's basically Fourier transform, and it includes, even if you started in the UV with an action that had only single trace interactions, you would generate general multi-trace interactions. Now, this, you know, multi-trace, when you learn about large N, you normally focus initially on the single trace interactions, and the multi-trace interactions come up in areas that seem exotic, special RG flows, and so on. But here they're coming up generically in the RG flow, and in fact they are generic. I won't go through it, but if you take the Wilson equation and you write it out in double line notation, various people, including starting with Miao Li, did this. And if you look at what it generates, in fact, even if you start from a single trace interaction, you see this on the field theory side, the process of integrating out generates arbitrary multi-trace interactions. So you're just seeing here, sort of on the supergravity side, something that you, there's a minus sign there, something that you already knew about in the gauge theory. But it suggests an answer to the question, where does the bulk come from? Where do the bulk fields come from in the following sense? Imagine that we take the gauge theory and we separate the path integral into, you know, unit by energy. And at each step, suppose we start with a single trace interaction. The result of integrating out fields in some slice generates a multi-trace interaction. And we can take that multi-trace interaction and undo it in this way, writing it again, basically introducing an auxiliary field to rewrite it as a single trace action. And so if you think about doing the path integral scale by scale, and at each point introducing, at each energy scale introducing this auxiliary field to one for every single trace operator to carry out this step, after you've integrated out all of the CFT fields, what you're left with is, in fact, a path integral in one higher dimension over these bulk-like fields. In fact, I think this is what Sung-Sik Lee is saying. Sung-Sik has, over the past several months, been trying to work with lattice gauge theory and to organize the large N limit in a holographic way. And I think this is essentially the same combinatoric that he's using. And it seems that it must be morally correct. And so it's sort of saying that this funny feature that the RG generates multi-trace interactions is not a bug, but a feature. It's a way to think about where the bulk fields come from. And now we come back to Steve's question, because in this way of doing things, it looks like, in terms of these fields, locality in this direction is trivial. It's by construction. What's not trivial is locality in the Poincaré direction. So somehow one hard problem has been exchanged for an equally hard problem, because if you do this, you won't generate anything that looks like a nice local bulk theory. The locality in the Poincaré directions will be of order this larger ADS scale, not the finer scales that we were talking about. And so it required, this is just kind of a kinematic framework. It still requires some argument to complete it. My hope was, coming back to part one, that that with the additional information that the CFT, again, I think the work of Douglas et al. Is very inspiring here. Somehow, looking at it right, things became simple. And it seems like if you supplement this by the additional information that says a gap in the spectrum of dimensions, you should have enough leverage to show that you obtain a local action in the bulk. But
is it specific that actually it was a gauge? So for example, if I would have two dimensional CFT,
right,
like Mesomino Witten, and try to play this game, I can.
You can play this game in any theory with matrix degrees of freedom. And so that's right.
W is a W, let's say.
But, right. You can do this in any theory of matrix freedom. It's going to, in general, give you a messy answer. You know, the question is, does it ever, you know, can we see that it gives a nice answer? Pardon? For vector models. He did for vector models. So,
I mean, if you want to get Einstein, but not
Vasiliev. Right. You want to get Einstein, but not Vasiliev. I feel like, you know, it's one more step from what I just said here, but I haven't, we haven't yet found that step.
Do you think that in your CFT2 should be a big simplification?
Not really. I think all the examples are sort of equally, I mean, there's some irreducible difficulty to all of this. They're all sort of T-dual. They're all the same level of.
It's just the hierarchy of dimensions then that would somehow allow you to go to much smaller.
Well, good. So the hierarchy of dimensions. So everything so far I have has been focusing on the supergravity limit, where you have the hierarchy of scales and you kind of integrate. You imagine integrating out all the string stuff and focusing on what's left, and ultimately. You need clearly to look at the entire theory, and particularly you need to look at the fact that it's a matrix theory. You need to look at the full theory. You need to look at the strings as well. You know, generically, you'll get everything, but everything is going to be non-local on scales large compared to what you need it to be local on.
Yeah. Could you imagine something like that in the old matrix model, say C equals 1 matrix model? Could you try, say, to derive this way? Dimension which we know in principle that it works.
Well, that's interesting, because there's a case where we have good. We have an interpretation of extra dimension in terms of the eigenvalues. That's a good question. I don't know offhand. Yeah.
Restore the cigar. Metric and the sigma model on the cigar from the corresponding
mm-hmm. So, you know, actually, it's an hour and I don't mean to answer your question. I don't have anything useful to say. It's a good question. I was going to say a few words about Wilson loops, but I'll just mention briefly how Wilson loops enter, even starting with the ingredients that we have, because this formalism we talked about expresses a local operator in the bulk in terms of and integral of local operators sneered over the boundary. And that's non-local in time, and you'd like to kind of refer, say, to a single time. What operator acting in the Hilbert space at this time creates an excitation here in the bulk? And again, if you can solve the gauge theory, you know what you do. You evolve in time. But of course, operators that are local in time initially, need another dimension in the picture. Operators that are local in time initially spread out. Their constituents spread out. We already talked about that. And so what's acting at this time is not a local operator, but what a local operator evolves into, which is a non-local operator, non-local gauge invariant operator. And any non-local gauge invariant operator we call a Wilson loop. So the operator at this time is some kind of superposition of Wilson loops. And that's kind of puzzling because Wilson loops we think of as creating long strings at the boundary. So how can they both create long strings at the boundary and also create localized excitations in the bulk? I think this is something that can be made sharper and more precise. And something which one needs to do to make sense of this is there's this old thing, the loop equations, which is one of these things which has absorbed lots of effort over time in Yang-Mills theory without really paying off yet. But they're not usually expressed as a time evolution in this sense. There should be a version of the loop equation. I think there is a version of the loop equations which is expressed as a time evolution for Wilson loop operators. There's another thing that one needs that one should have, which is that the standard dictionary for ADS-CFT is a dictionary between local bulk fields and local operators. For Wilson loops, we think of the dictionary as being a constraint that there's a string world sheet that ends on the given loop on the boundary. But there should be some corresponding operator version of this dictionary in which the Wilson loop operator in the boundary theory is the limit of some string field operator in the bulk. There should be some much larger analog of this dictionary at this level. And again, this is something which I think how useful it will be is not clear, but I think this is something that in fact can be sort of made more precise, and that maybe one can use this to make more precise the loop equations. Anyway, so I just want to mention, well, with Jamie we have some nice sort of technical results on renormalization group flows for BPS and non-BPS Wilson loop operators, which is just kind of an auxiliary to the question I just talked about. But I'll stop here. Thank you.
So
when I think about this, I reluctantly go to light cone gauge, because in light cone, there's two nice. Well, for one thing, it's kind of the most. One nice thing about light cone gauge is you have gauge invariances in the boundary, you have different gauge invariances in the bulk. Light cone gauge is a gauge that you can impose on both sides. And so you can sort of make a pointwise identification between what's happening in the bulk and in the boundary. So I sort of, it's what I'm thinking about is not background independent yet. It's just at the level of the light cone gauge fixing.
Once it picks the background, of course, then you have a notion of what does the bulk feels like measuring and so on.
Right,
but
right.
Otherwise, in general, frequency over is kind of discounted.
Yeah, that's more ambitious, but yeah.
Volume strings are kind of.
Yeah.
information?
This came in the middle.
Yes.
Seems to be almost the same as the normalization group.
Yes.
So what is the main point? This decoupling of traces? How precise can you make?
So, you know, just at the level of kind of combinatorics, there's not much more to say than I've already said. You can take any RG in a matrix theory, and there's a way to rewrite it in such a way at the end of the day, you're left with what looks like a bulk quantum field theory. So it gives you kind of just, again, the playground for where your theory is going to live. But clearly, But again, in general, and in general, most large N theories, this would be a formal thing that has no real value. To give it value, one has to see, you know, again, that things are simple or local in the bulk.
What, for example, if you take an across four young meals, what would guarantee the locality in the bulk?
Good. So it has to. So in general, good. In general, this is a flow in a very large space. Because trace f mu nu, any number of derivatives f mu nu, for example. But in n equals 4 strong coupling, these are all strongly irrelevant except for n equals 0. They're all non-chiral. And so what makes the n equals 4 theory at large lambda simpler is that in this flow, almost all directions are very rapidly convergent. So in this flow, the operators of these very high dimensions, the direction in which the RG is very rapidly convergent. And so it you end up flowing in a much smaller space. But that, again, smaller, but still, if you just do this in the most mechanical way, it still is non-local. Much more non-local than one expects the answer to be, and so we haven't found the right lever to show that it's as local as one expects it to be.
So, from the perspective of the first part of the talk, mm-hmm. one necessary condition for the right locality properties and so on is the correct singularity structure.
Right. Right.
And here it's. Stated in terms of properties of this effective action
in
this field. And so do you see any possibility of a direct connection to those, or are those somehow consequences of the matrix structure and the hierarchy of dimensions?
Well, this is more general. If you reduce the CFT to a field theory in the bulk,
then you go back.
So that's why this is a more general. I think of this as a more general way to ask the question than in the first part.
Because you may want to try to explain the singularity structure in the boundary theory directly and try to understand where it comes from, but if that was the answer, you would say it only comes through constructing this auxiliary field theory and then working back.
Well, the singularity is a structure is a if you take AD, if you it's a consequence of ADS-CFT. Once you have ADS-C duality, the singularities are there.
Well,
so you're asking in some sense derive ADS-CFT.
No, I'm just saying if you take say n equals 4 super Yang,
right.
Forget that there's any bulk dual, you don't know about it.
Right.
And you ask where does the singularity structure come from?
Right. So, I mean, in a certain sense, we derived it from crossing. That is, we showed that the four-point function was uniquely determined, and so in effect, we derived it from crossing. This is a more general way to try to derive it.
Let's take a look.